Welcome to the Film Florida podcast. I'm John Lux, and I'm the executive director of Film Florida. Before we get to our interview, if you're not already a member of Film Florida, please consider joining at filmflorida.org. Please also consider going to our website and donating $20.24 for our 2024 fundraising campaign. Visit the Film Florida merchandise page at filmflorida.creator-spring.com to purchase Film Florida t-shirts, sweatshirts, coffee mugs, and more. All merchandise proceeds go to the Film Florida Filmmaker Grant and Scholarship Fund. Born in Detroit, but raised in Florida, actor Tom Nowicki has more than 160 film and television credits, including a major role in the new series Bad Monkey on Apple TV+. We talked to Tom about his numerous roles in Florida-based projects, stories from his most well-known projects, how he got his start in the industry, and advice for young actors. Tom also runs Hip Dog Canine Hydrotherapy, a small organization that does swim therapy for injured and disabled dogs. We talk about all of this and more on this episode of the Film Florida Podcast. Here's my conversation with Tom Nowicki. Welcome to the Film Florida Podcast, Tom.
Thank you. I'm delighted to be here.
So tell us a little bit about your backstory. Where'd you come from?
So I was born and raised in Detroit. We moved here when I was 12. My father got an offer to come down and work for Disney. So he came down and scouted out Florida before the family moved down there. And he came back and told his two hockey-playing teenage sons that not to worry about it because life was going to be just like it is on Flipper. We'd be walking barefoot to school with our pet dolphins swimming beside us in the canal, picking oranges off the trees. Needless to say, he wasn't exactly truthful with us.
So big hockey players when you were younger?
Hockey player until just a few years ago. When I went into the boards the wrong way and tore up a knee.
So you got down to Florida, and tell us a little bit about how you found your way into our industry.
So in 10th grade, we were reading The Crucible in American literature class, and the teacher offered extra credit to anybody who would go down and read for the senior class play that year, which was The Crucible. I needed the extra 4 points. I went down and voila.
And never looked back from there, huh?
Well, yeah, many a time. That's the worst moment in my life, but it stuck. There's been nothing I could do about it. Yeah, I was cast as the Reverend Hale, which was way more than I thought that I could handle. But one of the most distinctive memories of my life was standing in the wings before my first entrance and wondering if I could even remember my lines, would I be able to get them out? Smash cut ahead 15 minutes, you know, after those first scenes are over, and I was a completely different person. Mm. I was exhilarated in a way that I've never been since.
And, you know, you obviously were hooked, but how long did it take you to realize this was going to be the career?
Honestly, I don't think I ever looked at it as a career. I looked at it as what I had to do with my life. Our teacher, Ann Derflinger, at Winter Park High School at the time, no one can explain how she was there. She was trained at the Royal Academy of Dramatic Art in London. How she wound up in Winter Park High School in the early 70s running this theater department. So it was a full-blown experience. It wasn't a trifle. She believed in the power of the theater to change the world. And she kind of required you to believe that too. She was difficult. She was demanding. She was incredibly inspiring. And she tolerated the idea of theater as entertainment, but you really were supposed to be aiming for the higher purposes. That carried me along a long way. Yeah. The idea of it being a career, I think, didn't happen until I was probably 40 years old and I realized this is how I was making my living, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. Now, typically when we have guests on the podcast, we kind of go chronologically through their career, but I don't want to do that here because I want to immediately jump to the present. And your newest production work includes the Apple TV Plus series, Bad Monkey. For those who haven't seen it, tell us kind of what the series is all about.
Bad Monkey was developed from a Carl Hiaasen novel. You know, Carl Hiaasen, Florida's premier comedy crime writer. And it follows the story of Andrew Yancey, who has played by Vince Vaughn, who has recently been suspended from his job as a detective with the Key West Police Force. Andrew is continuing to investigate a crime which begins when some tourists that I've taken out on a charter fishing trip reel in a severed human arm. You know, the Key West police want nothing to do with this because they figure, probably with some justification, that severed human body parts floating around in the Gulf are not good for the tourist business.
Sure.
But Andrew figures if he can figure out who the arm belonged to and what happened to him, solve the crime, he can get his job back. And off we go.
And now you have an interesting role on Bad Monkey. Tell us about your role and how you landed the gig.
I play Captain Keith Fitzpatrick. I am the skipper of the Misty Mama, a small charter fishing boat, and I'm good friends and drinking buddies with Andrew Yancey. I'm also the narrator of the show, and really no mystery to how I just auditioned and they liked me.
Yeah.
Casting directors like to enforce some rules in auditions, and I did a couple of takes of the audition on camera and following the prescribed procedures. And then I just thought, you know, this isn't working for this guy, and decided to go ahead and break as many of them as I had to in order to make this character come alive. And I guess they bought it. They looked past my trespasses and decided they wanted me to play the character. So lucky me, right?
Yeah, yeah. Now, I mean, is this the first time you've kind of had a dual role in terms of being a character as well as the narrator?
I have never actually done narration for a fictional TV series before or fictional film. The narration was not part of the original plan for the show.
Okay.
After they cut it together, I guess figured that they needed someone, because there are so many plot lines in the story, they needed someone to guide the audience between the two and link them together. And they decided that they wanted it not to be the voice of God or the author, but they wanted it to be a character in the show who was telling a story. And that the captain was the character best positioned to do that. So they offered me the job. And I really didn't know what I was getting into. It's like one of my favorite lines from film is from Spinal Tap, which is there's a fine line between between brilliant and stupid. That's the line to fall into when you're doing narration, you know, in a TV show. You've only got your voice to make your points, and I'm narrating in character, not as me.
Mm-hmm.
And you can't push too hard. You sound like a clown, and you could overwhelm what's happening in the scene. You also can't just lay back because, you have to get people's attention and do it. And happily for me, the producers on the show were very indulgent. Bill Lawrence and Matt Tarsies and Kip Kellogg took me by the hand and patiently guided me through this thing. I think one of my biggest problems was that the writers kept sending me lines that were so funny that I'd take 10 takes sometimes just to not howl trying to get through them. And they'd be looking at their watches and saying, Tom, studio time is kind of expensive. If you'd mind growing up, and getting your act together so we can do this. Way, way, way more fun than I expected it to be.
Yeah, yeah. I'm assuming you voiced it after it was already edited?
Yeah, and they sent me the lock cut of each episode so I could rehearse against it when I was preparing.
Yeah. Okay, and so you knew timing and stuff like that where you had to get things in, yeah. Yeah. So talk about, that was obviously a new challenge for you. I mean, how cool was that?
Yeah. Terrifying at first. So it was recorded here at a studio in Orlando called Fat Planet, but the producers were with me on Zoom and as we are now.
Uh-huh.
And so poor little nobody Tom is sitting in a lonely studio in Orlando with some of the biggest names in television judging his work.
Yeah.
Intimidating, terrifying, uh-huh, a little bit, because I do a take and they, okay, so let's go back. And it took a while, but happily we have the same sort of we like to work the same way, which is essentially beat it to death until we get everything out of it that we can. And they were really indulgent with me and really and they are who they are in TV because they are so darn good at it. They know, yeah, they know what they need and they know how to get it out of an actor. And they got it out of me, I guess.
Yeah. Yeah. The series was filmed in the Florida Keys, and you're obviously no stranger to acting in Florida-based productions. Some of the other ones you've been involved with, just to name a few here, Burn Notice, At the End of the Day, Bloodline, Dolphin Tale and Dolphin Tale 2, Free Ride, Letters to God, Magic City, Sheena, From the Earth to the Moon, and many others. You go all the way back to the Thunder in Paradise, Swamp Thing, Superboy, Miami Vice days here in Florida. Talk about what it's been like through your career to film in Florida, and maybe share a couple of fun stories from any of those in-state projects.
Okay. So most of the fun stories I have are either incredibly profane or involve people who are still alive and might come after me if I tell them. So it's been a really interesting ride. Back when I was starting, it seemed like anything was possible here. You know, there was so much production and so many people who were good at it, who were getting their, you know, their shows together, and things have obviously tapered off mm-hmm. in the last several years. What I have taken the most pride in are the shows that really tell a specifically Florida story, you know, yeah. like Miami Vice, like Bloodline, like Bad Monkey Now. And, you know, and the things that embrace Florida for everything that it is. One of my, again, going back to one of my favorite lines is the opening line in a book called Miami by T.D. Ullman, and I hope I get it right here, is one of the essential qualifications for running for governor in the state of Florida is an extensive criminal history. And so, you know, so I think that a great Florida story is something that embraces the fact that this paradise that we live in is constantly being preyed on by people who want to come in and pave it over, right? Yeah. And turn it into beachside timeshares. And not all the stories that I've been in have had that negative kind of overriding criminal element, but one of my favorite shows we've done here was The Cape, which was a series that was shot in the mid-90s over at the Cape, and it was about the contemporary space program. And we shot a lot at Kennedy Space Center on the real stuff. You know, mm-hmm. We stood there on the launch pad while they were putting the little chargers into the solid rocket boosters, and they noticed us down there, and they said, "Oh, you might not want to be here right now." In the beginning, the NASA was kind of wary of the production. They didn't know whether this thing would be, you know, whether it would be enthusiastic about the program or whether we were there to find all the nasty truths. Right. But once they trusted us, then they started to share. And the NASA started to kind of open up their files to the writers on what some of the missions that were called military missions mm-hmm. actually were about. And they were stories that were, I mean, heroic doesn't begin to describe how many times things in space went sideways. Yeah. And astronauts had to go up there with a minimum amount of preparation, a minimum amount of time, and put their lives on the line to actually save the planet. The names and the dates were changed in order to protect the heroes or protect NASA and whatever their concerns were. But we were able to put a lot of those stories basically out there so people could appreciate what the space program had done. Listen. My little favorite, not quite on the set story about that show, that after we shot the pilot, there was a wrap party that was done at a fish camp, you know, on the St. John's River that shall not be named in case they're worried. And everybody went out in one of those enormous airboats, and well, not everybody, but you know, the director of and the producers and a number of the stars, and they were Hollywood people and British people who were a little creeped out by the presence of alligators and snakes and all of the creepy crawly things in, you know, in a Florida swamp. And some prankster, who will also not be named, had given the boat driver $50 to stall out in the middle of the swamp so that same prankster could start singing the Gilligan's Island theme song and watch them all lose their mind.
Yeah, that's funny.
Yeah, I don't think they figured out who did that to this day.
Well, I mean, it's funny that, you know, one of the things that you mentioned is obviously, and you know this way better than I do from your time, is the authenticity of filming
things in Florida. And I think that's, for all of us that are living through some of the challenging times now, I think that's the hardest thing is when you see things set in Florida and you know that they're not authentic, to what we have here in the state. So I hear what you're saying there.
Yeah. I think, unfortunately, leaving politics out of it, there is still an attitude in our elected officials that our beaches and the paradise we live in is going to draw Hollywood just for, on its own sake, and that they won't accept the fact that you can go a couple hundred miles up the coast and have it look just enough like it that the state with an incentive is going to get all the work. So, I'm happy to keep beating my head against the wall to try to get an incentive here, but scars.
I know the feeling. I have some of those same scars, you and I together, that's for sure.
Yeah.
Now, you have also played the role of Jacob in Paranormal Activity Next of Kin. Now, this franchise is comprised of multiple films, with the first installment in 2007. The most recent one, the one you're featured in, came out in 2021. What was the process like as you prepared for your role and to contribute to such a well-known franchise?
Yeah. So, I'm not typically a horror fan. I had no familiarity with the paranormal franchise at all, and I think that may have been a key to my casting.
Okay.
That installment was meant to sort of close the door on the previous installment that they'd had and take it in a different direction. It wasn't all just a caught on camera kind of show. It was a combination of traditional narrative and first person point of view camera stuff. And there was a big spiritual undercurrent to that particular installment, a reexamination of the Abraham and Isaac story from the Bible, a family that's not fully human. And the family's responsibility for centuries has been keeping a demon captive in a cave underneath our farm out in Pennsylvania. And the way we can keep it weakened is by feeding it every so often a female from my bloodline. And when we meet Jacob, he's down to just one, the last one left, and he's tired of doing this.
Mm-hmm.
He is just sick and tired of sending an innocent into their doom, and has to wrestle with this responsibility, and thinking that, I've got one left. So this will last, 10, 15 years? What difference does it make now if the demon gets out now or in a decade, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the preparation for that was pretty interesting. And I was on the phone with the director, Will Eubank, constantly. They were, he was a fantastic director to work with, really open to my thoughts and to my ideas and suggestions. And I think the movie that we made, which this will get me in trouble, but not the movie that they released, I think we're both pretty proud of.
Yeah, that's cool. And now some of your other works include The Punisher, Satisfaction, Drop Dead Diva, Necessary Roughness, Remember the Titans, The Blind Side. You've been in some really well-known features and television series. Do you have, one or two favorites and things that kind of stand out to you as to why you enjoyed them so much?
Favorite thing that I've worked on prior to Bad Monkey was a show that was on AMC called Lodge 49.
Sure.
I shot in Georgia,
yep.
And again, for the same sort of seat of your pants creativity that they allowed us on that show. I respond well to that. I mean, I'm happy to do what's written on a page, but I think I get more excited when they say, well, we got that. Where can we go from here?
Mm-hmm.
And the writing was spectacular. The direction was so nurturing. And I was working with some people that I had admired for decades, including people that I saw working at the Yale Rep 40 years ago. And I thought, I want that man's career.
Wow.
So, yeah, it was a big, big, big thrill to work on the show. Devastating when we didn't get to come back for season three. But
I mean, your credits as just kind of listing them out are pretty wide ranging, Bad Monkey to Paranormal Activity type stuff. Other than you need to pay your bills. How do you decide which projects or which genres to kind of pursue? And how do you know if a role is going to be right for you?
John, I wish I had evolved to the point in my career where I could choose. Yeah, it is, when the audition comes in, am I available? Heck yeah, I'm going to audition for it. If I were to start choosing, I think I would stop working. And this is kind of note to young actors. I've learned that it's foolish to judge a role based on the audition that they send you. Some of the things that I have enjoyed the most, some of the things I've learned the most off of, have come from auditions where I thought, why would I want? There's no money behind this, or I don't know these people, or this seems dumb. But you open the door, and frequently some pretty, like Jim Carrey in Yes Man, you say yes to things you don't think you should be saying yes to, and small miracles happen. So some of the stuff, again, that I'm proudest of happened with auditions that I didn't think I wanted to do.
Oh, that's fascinating, and that's really great advice, actually. Now, it may just be the few things that I've seen you in, but you play a really good villain. Do you find it? Do you enjoy playing, kind of a bad guy role, or do you prefer, something different?
Yeah, the hero is for amateurs, man. playing the bad guy, bringing the heat is way, way, way more fun. Getting to explore those areas, the places that you can't or shouldn't be going to in your real life and everything. And this is way more latitude, way more opportunities to stretch yourself and to use your craft. I started in this business as a professional wrestler.
Okay. Not,
Lord Larry Oliver, evil genius of the South, 6-time world light heavyweight champion hailing from the Falkland Islands. Right?
I love that.
And so your job is just to get people pissed off. And you will never work for a more attentive audience than a wrestling audience. Nobody is there because their spouse bought season tickets, and on a Friday night, they're desperately trying to stay awake after a week's worth of work sitting in those comfy chairs in the theater. So you just have to get over the fact that they want to kill you, mm-hmm. But I've never lost my taste for that.
Oh, that's cool. Now, you've also gotten into some producing. Tell us about how that has evolved.
Because I wasn't getting the kind of work that I wanted.
Okay.
And back in those sort of Wild West days in Florida, when there were a lot of people, especially after Blair Witch Project hit, everybody with an extra $5,000 wanted to put their money with some independent producer who was going to make them, make them rich again. So the money was relatively easy to find, and there were a lot of people on the technical side who knew what they were doing, lots of talented people, lots of people, the good writers here with stories that they wanted to tell. And so we made a few. Turns out I have absolutely no gift for it. They were fun to do. I gave myself, very interesting roles to play. But I did learn that I wasn't cut out for it. That really is a job for a grown-up. So, yeah.
Now, you mentioned just a few minutes ago some of your advice in terms of, taking roles that people may not think are going to be great for them, but you have an extensive credit list. And the one thing that I noticed is you have had consistent work, and it's hard to get consistent work in our industry. What is, kind of your best advice to maintain that success and that consistency through the years?
I've been thinking about this question, and I've never thought that through as a strategy. I've had some basic rules with myself, which is just careful with my money, mm-hmm. stuff like that. And again, don't turn down auditions. You don't know where they might lead. Again, it's only been the last 20 years that I thought of it as a career rather than just what I did with my life. So I didn't think I had a choice. While I don't know what to do, I could say that advice to younger actors about what not to do. Ann Derflinger, the teacher from high school so many years ago, gave me the one piece of really good advice, which is stay hungry. I mean, I know that Arnold claimed to have said that, but it was Ann Derflinger many years before. And by which she meant, don't get lured into a sort of a support job that's going to start making you too comfortable. Actors are charming people. You know, people like to be around us. We're charismatic. So you take a job at a store to, you know, to make ends meet in between jobs. And the next thing you know, they're thinking, you know, this guy'd be great as an assistant manager. And you think, well, double the salary, that'll make life a whole lot easier. But that's a trap. Mm. You know, it's better to keep yourself a little bit hungry. And so that you don't wind up having responsibilities that mean you can't do that extra audition or you can't take that job because you have committed to running the store for 2 or 3 weeks. Kind of like a religious vocation. Take a vow of semi-poverty so that you can, as long as you can stand it, as long as you can still, you know, make yourself get through, make enough to get through so that you stay hungry enough to and available to take the next opportunity that comes.
Now, you mentioned, you know, your kind of first taste of acting in high school. Do you actually remember your first professional audition?
Yeah. The first professional audition for camera work at all was for a little tiny independent film shot in Ybor City called Phantom of the Ritz. And I was doing a play in Tampa at the time. It was a low budget, non-union production. And they came and asked if anybody in the cast wanted to audition for the show. And it was I remember having a condescending attitude toward it, kind of like, well, I'm a theater actor, you know, of course you'll love me. Hand me the script, I'll do the line. and they were incredibly charming and lovely people. And it worked out. And that was my first professional on-camera job. My first big audition for a feature film was for a film called Harry and Son, directed by Paul Newman, in which he also starred. And again, going back to high school, and Derfflinger's hero was Paul Newman. She thought that he was the epitome of the American actor. We studied his work relentlessly in her classes. So my first feature film audition is for essentially my god, Paul Newman. And I remember walking in the door. The audition took place in the marina in Fort Lauderdale, where the film was being shot.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a weird sort of room. You walked in the door down a corridor, and as you got closer, you could see the end of the table that the auditioners were behind, and this pair of very skinny, very pale white legs stuck up on that table in yellow socks and navy blue boat shoes. Those legs belonged to Paul Newman. And I know he did it intentionally because those skinny white legs made you understand that he was not actually an immortal being that had descended from on high in a place that you couldn't possibly reach. He was actually another human being who probably did want you to do a great job. He was looking forward to you impressing him. And so he could solve his casting problem that he had. It was the most disarming thing.
Wow.
And just, you know, brilliant. And, he did cast me, and it was, one, confirmed everything that Ann Derfflinger had us expect about him, and B, laid the foundation for the way I have worked ever since. It was transformational and critically important moment in my career, both personally and in the technique with which I approached working on camera.
So, yeah.
Yeah. And I have some stories, but they tend to go on. I don't know if you want to hear them or not.
Give us one of them. Give us a good Paul Newman story.
All right. So Tom makes a rookie mistake, big rookie mistake. Night before I'm supposed to start shooting, I've already been down to have, you know, wardrobe fitting and the makeup test. Instead of driving, and you know, shooting in Fort Lauderdale, I live in Orlando. And instead of driving all the way down that night and staying in the hotel, I stop at a friend's house in West Palm Beach. Figuring I'll just get up an extra 20 minutes earlier, I'll drive down. Of course, that morning, my car won't start.
Mm-hmm.
And this is long before cell phones or anything like that. So I have to take a taxi. And my friend doesn't have a car, only a bicycle. So I take a taxi to the bus station, a bus to Fort Lauderdale, and then another taxi to the set. By the time the taxi is pulling up, I'm about 3 hours late. And again, wow. No cell phone, no way to warn anybody. So the taxi's pulling up. I'm throwing money at the cabbie. The door's opening. I'm running toward the set. And we were shooting in a parking garage in downtown Fort Lauderdale. And as I turn to go down the ramp, up the ramp by himself is walking Paul Newman, nailing me with those famous blue eyes. And I just stopped. I thought, this is it. This is the end. I'm about to be ripped to shreds in public by my God. My career is over here, and just hung my head and waited.
Mm-hmm.
Next thing I knew, he had me in a bear hug. And he's saying, thank God you're safe, Tom. Thank God you were here. We're all so completely worried about you, man. Are you okay? Are you all right?
Wow.
So catch your breath. We're walking you down to the set, okay? Because we, you know, while we're waiting, we went ahead and blocked the scene for camera. Once you go up to the camera, look through the lens. I'm going to walk your blocking. If there's anything you need me to adjust, you think the lighting isn't right or anything, tell me. We'll fix it. And then we'll send you up for makeup and hair. But we want to get this thing rolling right now because we're a little bit behind for the day.
Mm-hmm.
Given a choice between tearing a young rookie idiot into pieces and ruining any chance that I had, even for a successful, you know, day on the set, let alone a career, or treating me like a valued colleague whose contribution to the film he was anticipating.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't made those many of those kinds of mistakes again, thank goodness.
Uh-huh.
But I don't know that many people would have made that choice. And that generosity was typical both of him as a person and of his way of working. Listening closely to what other actors were saying, both on the set while they were working and had ideas that they had, embracing them, and, you know, those ideas, encouraging them and nurturing them. And, you know, if anybody had the right to dismiss anybody else's idea, it would have been Paul freaking Newman, right?
Uh-huh.
That wasn't the way. And the added the tone that he had on the set was of collegiality, and everybody's equally important to him. Sort of postscript to that is that the scene took place. I played a guy who repossesses cars for a living, and I bring my brand new Corvette in to be detailed by Robbie Benson, playing Paul Newman's son, okay, who was there with his pregnant girlfriend, played by Ellen Barkin. And then at the end of the scene, I back the car out and drive it up the ramp from the parking garage. And so we shoot that a couple of times, and Paul leans into the car and says, all right, we got that. Do you think you might be able to, like, you know, light the tires up a little bit and put a button on the scene as you're heading out? And again, this is Paul Newman, God, leaning into the window and basically asking you, are you a man or a mouse? Of course I can do it. Why not? I'll be able to do it. So roll the cameras, and I get the smoking the tires part right. What I don't get right is keeping the car under control.
Oh, okay.
And the back end breaks loose, and I hit a light stand with an 18K on it. It falls over onto the back of the Corvette, smashing both the car and the light.
Ugh.
Smoke clears, and, you know, the screaming dies down, and, you know, Paul Newman again leans in, and I'm thinking, all right, this is it. If being late hasn't caused me to be fired, this is it. And he just leans in again and said, okay, we got that. Maybe next time I drive.
Did you ever tell him why you were late?
You know, I don't recall, but you know, I don't think he brought it up.
Wow, that's amazing. That's amazing. I mean, we could keep going with that, but tell me a little bit, how have you seen, I mean, you mentioned a little bit how the industry has evolved here in the state of Florida, for better or for worse, of course. But talk about, you know, how the overall industry, from your perspective, has evolved through your career.
You know, technology has been both helpful and not. I think,
yep,
you know, I think on the positive side, being able to, you know, record auditions and send them wherever you want to has made opportunities happen more frequently, and it's less expensive to be an actor. I love to be in the room in an audition. You know, I just love to be able to work with people and have that interchange. On the set, when you're working, technology has sped things up to a point where producers are becoming more interested in that rule of time is money. You know,
okay,
so you're getting less latitude to create. Their budgets are getting smaller, and the time to work is getting smaller. So there's less opportunity to explore things. But, it's clearly a double-edged sword. And I don't know if AI fulfills its promise. I think it's going to be an entirely different world that I'm not looking forward to. But I think that remains in the hands of the audience. If the audience will accept AI-generated entertainment, then I think actors are in trouble. But yeah. I'm hoping that we'll be pulling for live human beings, doing live human being things, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I hope you're right too. I mean, just my personal opinion, I think you're going to be right. I think people will accept a certain level of AI, but I think, I don't think they're going to give up on the humans on screen nearly as much as maybe the sky is falling people want us to believe. At least that's my hope for humanity is that. So.
Me too. And I, you know, hope springs eternal with me. I'm just incredibly naive.
Yeah. Now, completely outside of the industry, I want to talk to you about a personal endeavor you have, and you run Hip Dog Canine Hydrotherapy, which is an organization that does swim therapy for injured and disabled dogs. Tell us about what it is and how you got involved in such a cause.
Okay. So I was flying home after working on a show, and someone had left a copy of Whole Dog Journal in the seat back pocket in front of me. And that edition was dedicated to this new idea in the States of swim therapy for, you know, for injured and disabled dogs. My partner Christina Latimer had a three-legged Brittany Spaniel named Cosmo, and so I thought, well, this would be perfect for him. Took it home. She had a pool, so we decided that we would get the training, and so we could help Cosmo. Once we got involved in the training, we sort of, you know, looked at each other and thought it would be sort of selfish of us just to keep us, you know, to ourselves. So why don't we open it up in case there are other people in Central Florida who could use it? Never expecting it would be anything more than a couple of dogs a week, you know, that we'd be able to help. That's 23 years ago. And now we're doing between 50 and 60 dogs in the course of, you know, any given week. But not ourselves. We have some people who work with us.
Wow.
And I know I don't
have to begin to explain how good it feels to help a dog that's having difficulty move around do better.
Yeah.
I can promise you that there are many days now when I don't really feel like going to the pool in the morning, but there's never been a day in these 23 years when I haven't finished a day thinking that there was anything better I could have done with my time.
Yeah. Wow.
Yeah.
That's a lot.
It is.
How can people learn more about that specifically?
Well, we have a website, Hip Dog Canine Hydrotherapy. It's not the secret that it was 20 years ago. There's lots of places that do it and lots of places that give information. You know, as we like to say, it's not rocket surgery what we do. It's, you know, pretty simple and straightforward, but the results are pretty breathtaking. Back in the beginning, we had a dog named Maggie, who was, I think, a 9 or 10 year old golden, who, when her mom brought her in, she was afflicted with arthritis, basically from, you know, the bottom of her skull to the tip of her tail. And her mom had to carry her in. And about 2 or 3 months later, Maggie came, I think, 3 times a week. She was, in fact, she became a cover girl for Dog Magazine, because at that, we ran a video of Maggie, door opens in the car, and Maggie springs out, runs the end of the pool and jumps in. And the, you know, again, it wasn't like we did anything special or miraculous. We just worked with her with some swimming and some stretching and some massage, and became an entirely different dog. It's, you know, it's available pretty much to anybody with access to a pool. You know, not hard to learn how to do. Or if you want to bring them to people who do it, you know, then there's us, and there's plenty of other locations. I think there's probably 30 locations in Florida right now.
Okay.
Where people can send it to help for their dogs.
That's awesome. Okay. So remind people where they can see Bad Monkey. Tell people how they can learn more about you, follow you, learn more, all that.
Bad Monkey plays on Apple TV Plus. That was 10 episodes. And I am completely uninvolved in social media. Sorry. I basically don't want to go on there and find out the bad things people think about me. So,
well, you are most likely better off because of it. I can tell you that much. Well, Tom, I sincerely appreciate you being with us today. This has been a lot of fun. I loved all the great stories and, of course, all the great stuff you're doing for the dogs here in Central Florida. Thanks so much for being on the Film Florida podcast.
Thank you, John. It was a delight to be here.
Thanks for listening to the Film Florida podcast. For more information about Film Florida, go to filmflorida.org and like or follow our social media pages. If you're not already a member of Film Florida, please consider joining at filmflorida.org. Please also consider going to our website and donating $20.24 for our 2024 fundraising campaign. Check out the Film Florida merchandise at filmflorida.creator-spring.com. And please remember to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast.